Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line on a Thursday afternoon in sunny and warm Phoenix, Arizona. Starting off the program today and taking your phone calls at 877-753-3341. Answering an email that has come in regards to talking with Muslims, asking if it is a good idea to talk about Muhammad and his life, talking about verses that refer to violence in the Quran, and the fact that the goal of believing Islam is the establishment of the Sharia law all over the globe in all nations. And to use this as an argument against Islam, especially in light of those who would turn to the Old Testament and ask if you can go to the Old Testament and find God establishing wars in the people of Israel going into the land of Canaan, warring prophets of the Old Testament, laws against apostasy, stoning, then why couldn't someone accept Muhammad and to those who would do the same thing? Now, of course, unfortunately, when Christians engage these subjects, today anyway, the large portion of those who are in, shall we say, post-evangelical churches, functionally have a 27-book canon. And they know so little about the Old Testament that they are really stretched to the breaking point to give much of a meaningful presentation as to what the Old Testament is about, what took place in the Old Testament, to make sure that what is said about what took place in the Old Testament is balanced and accurate, and then especially to establish a meaningful connection between the Old Testament and its fulfillment in the New. And so it is very common for people to raise issues in regards to the Old Testament and to the theocratic laws and things like that, and basically get away with it as far as most modern day believers. But when someone says, well, look, the Jews did everything that we are doing. Of course, I don't think they did. I don't recall suicide bombers and things like that. But the Jews were seeking to establish a theocratic kingdom. Islam is seeking to establish the Islamic worldview and the Ummah, the Sharia law in all lands to the glory of God, etc., etc. And so these things are supposed to be parallel to one another. Of course, the main thing that forgets is that we don't have just the Old Testament. We have the Scriptures, Old Testament and New Testament together. And it is interesting to me that that both Muslim apologists and Jewish apologists sound very much alike. And in some ways, interestingly enough, on some aspects, especially in regards to priesthoods and things like that, Mormons get to jump into the fray here as well, because each of these groups in different ways take a step back from the fulfillment that is found in the New Testament. For example, Mormons go back to the Old Testament ways concerning priesthoods and things along these lines. In the same way, I guess I could argue along that line, that the Roman Catholics do as well as far as the establishment of some sort of sacerdotal priesthood. But both Muslims and Jewish apologists, in essence, go back to the same foundation. They reject the New Testament's fulfillment motif. They reject the idea that this is what the Old Testament was pointing toward and that there is a fulfillment. And especially do they miss the fact that the New Testament gives us a completely different paradigm of defining the people of God. Now, in the sense that the people of God have truly always been identified by faith in the one true God, then that remains the same. But there are clearly differences between a theocratic state through which the Messiah comes into the world, and then the fact that the Church of God is now going to be built up not by any kind of genetic relationship, but instead through the proclamation of the gospel and the building of the church from men and women of every tribe, tongue, people, and nation, that the gospel is going to go out, and that by the work of the Holy Spirit and the proclamation of the gospel, that the church is going to be built over time. Therefore, to step away from the New Testament means that you have to go back to the Old Testament paradigm, where you basically have the rule of the sword in attempting to establish a theocratic state, which you have in a similar fashion with Islam. But that requires you to, in essence, reject Jesus. The Jews reject Jesus, and therefore in the New Testament, Islam likewise rejects Jesus, and despite all their protests to the contrary, it is very clear that the Islamic Jesus is not the Christian Jesus. The Islamic Jesus is not a Jesus known to Christians, not known to the New Testament, not known to history, for that matter. And it is interesting. I was listening to a clip. In fact, I could probably bring it up here if I worked that quickly enough. But a clip that I'm inserting into a PowerPoint presentation where Shabir Ali made the statement in our debate at Biola that scholars are coming more and more to the same conclusions about who Jesus is and farther away from Christians. What he means by that, of course, is liberal, unbelieving scholars are creating this picture of a Jesus who's basically nothing but an apocalyptic prophet and type of, you know, something along these lines. And so it doesn't shock me at all that unbelieving scholars would be coming to the same type of conclusions as Muslims have been teaching, because there's a reason for that. Neither of them accepts the inspiration of the New Testament. And hence, I don't think either has any basis upon which to be trying to create a portrait of Jesus in the first place. It becomes, for the Muslim, you have to find Muhammad's Jesus. And what did Muhammad know about Jesus? Precious little. Very, very little indeed. And so you don't have the biblical Jesus in that type of context. So I think you can utilize these instances from Muhammad's past and from the teachings of the Quran to demonstrate that this is not a continuation, as he claimed, of Old Testament, New Testament, now Quran. It's not, unless you pull the same stunt that all Islamic apologists have to do and look backwards. Remember, Islamic anachronistic exegesis, look backwards through time and throw out the New Testament. If you actually allow Old Testament to be fulfilled in New Testament, now you have this way of building the church, proclamation of the gospel. And what does Muhammad do? He goes right back. He steps completely backwards away from the fulfillment of the New Testament. And why? Can anyone prove that Muhammad had any kind of meaningful knowledge of New Testament theology at all? The answer is no. You cannot. There is no reason to believe that this man had any meaningful knowledge of what the New Testament was all about in the first place. He's going on second, third, fourth, and fifth hand information, and it's flawed, and it has errors in it, and therefore there are errors in the Quran as well. And the Muslim says, I can't accept that because I have been taught that this is just the way that it is, and the Quran does not reflect Muhammad's understanding. Instead, it reflects an eternal verity from God. And so I have to throw out the New Testament as a result. And therefore, you have the anachronism that takes place at that point. So you can utilize those things to demonstrate, in the argument being that Muhammad has stepped back out of ignorance from the fulfillment in Christ, and therefore his claims of being a prophet in that line are therefore invalidated. But the Muslim, of course, is going to continuously respond in the anachronistic method of looking backwards in history, using the lens of the Quran and the overriding commitment to the prophethood of Muhammad, and rejecting and dismissing anything that stands in that in the way of that particular concept. 877-753-3341 is the phone number for today's program. A programming note about next week. There isn't any. we will not have a dividing line on Tuesday or Thursday of next week because I will not be available to do that, but will be, Lord willing, as long as health holds out, back the Tuesday thereafter, which I believe is the 3rd of July. Yes, it's the 3rd of July. So, that's when we will have it. I love cough buttons. That you don't have to use them just for coughing. If you just, for some reason, got a yawn, you can yawn.
Man, the air must be getting a little thin in there. Huh?
It's actually warming up fairly quick. I was a little surprised.
I'm going to have to turn the AC down so we can get some frost on things.
Either that or go get me a Mountain Dew. one of the two. Man, nappy time or something. I don't know. Sometimes you just... You know, yawning is supposed to increase the oxygen level. And sometimes, I don't know, if you're talking too fast or something, you just gotta yawn. It's terrible. Anyway, and if I did that on the air, then you know what the freaky thing is? People in the audience would yawn too. Why? Here is one of the great mysteries I'm going to have to inquire of in eternity to come. How is it that yawns are contagious? Why is it? You know it's true. You've all seen it happen. You see one person yawning. I've actually had people say it has to do with air pressure, if you can believe
It's sin.
It's sin?
Yes. You know, you see one person do it, and the next person does it, and then they see it's the... You ain't going to make me do it. You try it all you want, you ain't going to make me do it.
It's sin. Now, I've never even thought of associating with the fallen nature before. I really, really haven't thought
it, of it. It's evil.
It's evil
yawning
to do?
Yawning is evil, you bet.
I think yawning's not evil at all. I bet you Adam yawned. Now, I've started something now because Benny Hinn said that Adam could fly, and now someone's going to say that James White thinks that Adam yawned.
Yeah.
Now, there's what happens when you get into speculative theology.
There's another soundbite.
Oh, goodness. We better get better get back to the program here. Even people in Chandler are going, sin? Sin, Rich? Sin? What in the world is that? I mean, they know what sin is. They just don't think that yawning is. Yeah, I mean, if that's sin, then you are quite the legalist. Let me put it that way. You know, there you go. There you go. All right. Let's get back to the debate here, especially because if there's a thing coming up. I've had this book sitting here so long, it's leaving. It's starting. I'm gonna have to blow the dust off of it. All to get this one point in the debate. We got to get to it eventually, or we'll never get it done. How long I think we got 3 minutes of the debate done last time. We need to get a few more minutes in. Let's press forward here.
Has told it the way he thought it ought to be told. Given this evolution of the Gospels, peeling back to the earliest strata of tradition, can you be satisfied in the earliest strata of tradition Jesus actually died on the cross?
I can't help but hearing him talking about peeling back to the earliest strata of tradition. There's a part of me that goes, this is the Shrek methodology of examining the New Testament. You're looking confused. You don't understand that? The Shrek, ogres are like onions. You obviously have not seen it enough to be able to make the immediate connection there. That's the Shrek methodology of Islamic eisegesis.
And that he reappeared to his disciples in a physical bodily form. Offer evidence of that.
I have. It's the early oral traditions and Paul himself. You mentioned the Gospels, but again, I'd like to express I'm willing to grant you the Gospels have legend and errors and all kinds of problems for tonight's debate. But I'm still on this other hill, and I'm waiting for you over here. Now, you had mentioned about... No, I'm not going to ask you a question. I'm sorry. You said that...
What? You can't just wait and let him ask the question.
Okay. I'll wait for him. No statement that Jesus died in the earliest strata? Well, yes, there is. I mean, in that creed that was within 5 years, and James Dunn, in his new book, Jesus Remembered, said that this, to the tradition in this creed, dates back to within months of the crucifixion. Months. And the creed says that he died, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day. And then you go down a couple of verses later, What's really interesting is Paul says in verse 1, I'm going to preach to you the gospel. And then he gives the creed in verses 3 through 8. And then in 9 he says, hey, whether it's me or they, the apostles, the disciples, we preach Jesus and him crucified. In other words, forgive me. He says, we're preaching about the resurrection of Jesus. So there Paul's saying he's preaching the same thing as the disciples are. You go down a few more verses, I think it's verse 14, and he calls this kerygma, kerygma. In other words, he's identifying it as the formal and official preaching of the disciples. So, I mean, this is very early tradition. And then we have Paul again. He mentions resurrection or dead and raised 30 times in his writings. And then you've also got the creed in Romans chapter 1, verse 3 and 4 that talks about declared the Son of God with power by his resurrection from the dead. So resurrection is in the earliest strata. There is nothing earlier. That I mean, we can go trace it back to the disciples themselves. So you could say that they're mistaken, perhaps, or, I mean, I'll let you raise the theory there. But they interpreted their experiences as being resurrection, which means they understood Jesus of dying. They understood that the body that died was the body that was raised and appeared to them. And so, therefore, the tomb was empty.
Yes, I can see that you feel that I'm not really dealing with your points. But in fact, if you listen carefully, I have been dealing with your points all of the time. Because, look, you have said fact number one, that Jesus died on the cross. And I'm saying the earliest strata of tradition cannot convince you that Jesus actually died on the cross. Now, it's for you to respond to this, but let me lay them all out. First, notice in Mark's gospel that Pilate has a doubt that Jesus actually died. And for good reason, because crucifixion usually took several days to kill a person. And in Mark's gospel, Jesus was only on the cross for a few hours.
Now, let me just stop right there. I've heard this a couple of times. The speed at which Jesus dies. How is this an argument? How is it? I mean, again, if these sources are basically corrupt sources, as Shabir is arguing, then why would you include this information in the first place? Why would you even make reference to Pilate's doubt? It's immediately pointed out in those same texts that the reason that he has died is well, what? That he has control over these things. And that the Romans then verify to Pilate, who is one of them, and the Romans tended to know about whether people were dead or not, even though amazingly, Shabir's going to spend a tremendous amount of time arguing later about his whole approach is going to be to cast doubt on the medical abilities of the ancient world to know when someone is dead, to try to, in essence, resuscitate the swoon theory. Pun fully intended, to come up with an explanation for all of this stuff, which to me smacks of, especially when you step back for just a moment from the debate and go, why is he questioning this? When even the likes of John Dominic Crossan or Marcus Borg accept the reality of the death of Jesus, why is Shabir doing this? And there's only one reason. Because of the visions of a man in Arabia 600 years later who had no connection to the original events. That's the only reason. And Shabir at least was open about it at the beginning of his presentations that, yeah, I'm a believing Muslim. I understand the Quran to teach this. And therefore, you know, that's where I'm coming from. And so I recognize that. And so that plays into my examination of the facts. Well, it certainly does. And it certainly is in this context, too.
And all of the beatings that are there in Gibson's movie are just imagination, because Mark does not give you any of those details. It is true that some such beating could have been possible for a crucified victim in the Roman world, but notice also that Pilate was sympathetic towards Jesus. He found him innocent and sought to release him, but he was pressured into agreeing to have Jesus crucified beyond his will. And I think Mel Gibson had it right when he showed the difficulty that Pilate was in there, and he was caught between a rock and a hard place. He finally agreed to have Jesus crucified, but giving that reticence from Pilate, it is possible that his men would not have delivered to Jesus the most brutal punishment possible, and that finally Jesus might not have died on the cross.
The one thing that...
I'm sorry, but there's just some huge, huge, huge stretches here. So somehow the Roman soldiers are discerning Pilate's mood or a favorable attitude toward Jesus, and therefore they're not going to beat him as badly or something. Again, man, I really wish the Gibson stuff wasn't even here. You know, it's just such a, you know, so overblown and so done in such a way, just sort of ruins the application here. But anyway, so this somehow means that Jesus wouldn't have died? Again, you have to just tear everything out of these texts, and there's no way, unfortunately, Lycona, because of the willingness that he has expressed to say, well, for the purposes of this debate, and he said, I don't believe this, but for the purposes of this debate, I'm willing to allow for all sorts of myth and allegory and so on, and errors and stuff in the texts of the New Testament. Well, now you don't have a context in which to respond to these things. Because you've basically stepped off of the only foundation that you can actually stand on. And that, again, here's the difference. Here is where your viewpoint of presuppositional versus evidential apologetics will even directly impact your methodology within an interfaith contact, an interfaith context, is, from my perspective, if you're trying to argue somebody onto the position, if you're standing there on the firm foundation of God's revelation and trying to show inconsistencies in somebody else's position and then bringing them to your own, you can't step off of that onto some alleged neutral ground. What other neutral ground is there to step on? You're being epistemologically inconsistent to do that. That's why whenever I hear him saying, well, you know, for the purposes of debate, no, you can't do that. It creates a impossible situation.
Might have killed him would have been the spear wound, but that is mentioned only in the Gospel according to John. That is the last of the four Gospels. Remember.
Now you hear that. This is over and over and over again. We don't know the order in which the Gospel is written. That's all hypothetical. Even those who just spend their whole careers on it have to admit that it's a hypothesis. Well, we have Mark first, and then not really sure about Matthew and Luke, and then you've got John at the end. Well, that's very common, but to do what he's doing here, and that is, in essence, say, well, if it's only mentioned in the last one, then it can't have any verity to it. There might be a million different reasons. Let's even grant that John's the last one. Why does that mean that John's mentioning it isn't relevant? There's all sorts of things that John mentions that are historically certain. He's the one that talks about the nails, and that's one of the issues that could come up here a little bit later on. Isn't it much more plausible that if John is the last one writing, that he actually could discuss many more things than maybe others who are writing while the contemporaries are still alive couldn't, and therefore he might have more historical information to share that he now has the freedom to be able to talk about because he's not going to be endangering people in the process? I mean, if you want to start into this theorizing stuff, there's really no end as to how far you can take it. That really becomes part of the issue.
And that represents the last shadow of evolution among the Gospels. And if that spear wound was delivered, you'd be sure that all of the Gospel writers would mention it because it's such a pertinent fact that would finally prove that Jesus died.
Why? Gotta catch him here again. There wasn't any question that Jesus died. This wasn't a debate. This was the fundamental application. This is a fundamental element of the proclamation of the church. This was not an issue. And it's not for at least 100 years or more until you have anybody coming along saying otherwise. The Basilidian Gnostics is a very tiny little group with no connection and no historical validity to them, denies the death of Christ. But they do so because of their Gnostic tendencies. It's tough to kill a spirit with a spear, you know. It doesn't even have historical meaning to it. And then you got to go, 600 years down the road to get to Muhammad for another reason. That they weren't trying to prove what Shabir is denying because nobody was denying it. And so to say, well, everybody would have mentioned this because it would have proven this point. That's an invalid form of argumentation. It is assuming that the New Testament writers could somehow have a knowledge of every single possible argument that was ever going to be raised against their position, and therefore would include every fact that could ever be needed to refute whatever mankind comes up with down through the ages. And obviously, that would mean that the New Testament would have to be many volumes long of microfiche to be able to contain all of the information that it would need to have in that context.
These give strong evidence for that case, and they do not mention it. The scholars think today that this is an imaginative detail added by John's gospel.
Now, and over and over again, and I'm going to have to challenge him again, because I can guarantee he's going to do this in October. As long as you can find someone who's published and who graduated from a school, it doesn't matter how coherent their arguments are. It doesn't matter that he would reject in entirety their worldview or anything else. As long as Shabir can find a single person who's published, scholars say it. And he'll just use this broad brushstroke, scholars believe this. That's not a scholarly way of arguing. That's a popularist way of arguing. It's very easy to say scholars reject these claims of Islam. Scholars recognize that the Quran is drawing from previous sources, and scholars say that, and he's not going to accept any of that. He's going to reject all that. He's going to ask for specifics, and he's going to ask you to, and rightfully so, but not rightfully so when he himself is not doing it. And so scholars see this as it. Well, you know what? When it comes to the New Testament and comes to Christianity, you can find a scholar somewhere who believes anything. That means absolutely nothing. The real issue is who can give you meaningful, consistent argumentation, not just throw out a book and get it published.
In order to prove against the docetists that Jesus was actually flesh and blood, because we have here the blood and water proving that he is actually real flesh and blood. He's not here as a spirit on the cross.
So if John has a concern, the docetists, from the Greek term dachein, which means it seems, the docetists who taught the Jews only seemed to have a physical body. So since John has a concern about docetism, then he's just going to make stuff up. So it would follow logically, for example, that when men came to Uthman with a concern about the purity of the Quran, then logically it would follow that they, as a result, because they had a concern, therefore corrupted the manuscripts they had to create an artificial harmony in the Quran, right? I mean, that does follow logically, right? If you have a concern about something, especially a perversion of something, then that means you are going to pervert your sources so as to argue against what you're concerned about. That seems to be what Shabir was just saying about John. So why wouldn't it be true about Uthman? In fact, I would argue that since the Quran never mentions Uthman, but the Quran does mention the disciples of Jesus and says that Allah would grant them victory, then there'd be more reason to believe that Uthman would do something like that and less to believe that John would. But this consistency thing sort of gets boring after a while, doesn't it?
As some docetists believe. And so we have, within the early strata, no firm evidence that Jesus actually died on the cross. So I've dealt with you fact number one.
No, actually he hasn't dealt with fact number one at all, because the earliest strata that he has been, that Mike Lycon has been trying to present here, is found in such places as 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And there can be no question about the meaning of died and was buried and rose again. But Shabir has such a deep and consistent anti-Pauline bias that it's difficult for him to even begin to see Paul as having any kind of meaningful historical capability as far as transmitting any type of tradition or anything like that. He just simply won't allow it to happen. Well, 877-753-3341. Someone is calling that number even now, but we're going to take a break and come back maybe with a phone call or with Shabir Ali or whatever else it might be here on The Dividing Line, 877-753-3341. We'll be right back.
How the Pilgrim's Progress is not an easy way. It's a journey to the sun, day by day. of following Jesus is a walk of grace.
What is Dr. Norman Geisler warning the Christian community about in his book Chosen But Free? A new cult? Secularism? False prophecy scenarios? No, Dr. Geisler is sounding the alarm about a system of beliefs commonly called Calvinism. He insists that this belief system is theologically inconsistent, philosophically insufficient, and morally repugnant. In his book, The Potter's Freedom, James White replies to Dr. Geisler, "But the Potter's Freedom is much more than just a reply. It is a defense of the very principles upon which the Protestant Reformation was founded. Indeed, it is a defense of the very gospel itself." In a style that both scholars and laymen alike can appreciate, James White masterfully counters the evidence against so-called extreme Calvinism, defines what the Reformed faith actually is, and concludes that the gospel preached by the Reformers is the very one taught in the pages of Scripture. The Potter's Freedom, a defense of the Reformation and a rebuttal to Norman Geisler's Chosen But Free. You'll find it in the Reformed Theology section of our bookstore at aomen.org. Public Crimes. The Criminal Mishandling of God's Word may be James White's most provocative book yet. White sets out to examine numerous crimes being committed in pulpits throughout our land every week, as he seeks to leave no stone unturned. Based firmly upon the bedrock of Scripture, one crime after another is laid bare for all to see. The pulpit is to be a place where God speaks from His Word. What has happened to this sacred duty in our day? The charges are as follows. Prostitution using the gospel for financial gain. Pandering to pluralism. Cowardice under fire. Felonious eisegesis. Entertainment without a license. And cross-dressing, ignoring God's ordinance regarding the roles of men and women. Is a pulpit crime occurring in your town? Get Pulpit Crimes in the bookstore at aomen.org. The history of the Christian Church pivots on the doctrine of justification by faith. Once the core of the Reformation, the Church today often ignores or misunderstands this foundational doctrine. In his book, The God Who Justifies, theologian James White calls believers to a fresh appreciation of, understanding of, and dedication to the great doctrine of justification, and then provides an exegesis of the key scripture texts on this theme. Justification is the heart of the gospel. In today's culture, where tolerance is the new absolute, James White proclaims with passion the truth and centrality of the doctrine of justification by faith. Dr. J. Adams says, "I lost sleep over this book. I simply couldn't put it down." James White writes the way an exegetically and theologically oriented pastor appreciates. This is no book for casual reading. There is solid meat throughout, an outstanding contribution in every sense of the words. The God Who Justifies by Dr. James White. Get your copy today at aomen.org.
I hate interrupting that one. I just want to play the air guitar with it, you know.
Need my Oakley so I can swing back.
Ah, yes, that's one of my favorites. 877-753-3341. We have a question about chronic evidence. And I was going, chronic evidence? No, cornic. Cornic evidence. And I'm going, cornic evidence? What is cornic evidence? And then I eventually figured out.
Hey, this little keyboard is this old.
Oh, blame it on the keyboard.
You know,
yeah.
These keys all bunched together.
Wait a minute. Hold on a second. The K is next to the J, and the Q is a row above on the other side of the universe.
Paying no attention to the man.
There you go. Anyway, let's talk with Johnny, who wants evidence of the Quran or whatever it is there. Hi, Johnny.
Hey, how are you, Jim?
Doing pretty good.
Good. I was actually asking because of the debate that you had last year with Shabir Ali on the subject of the New Testament and its inspiration. One of the points that you kept championing in the debate was that there is a double standard that Muslims are applying to how they deal with the New Testament, the Bible as a whole, but the New Testament specifically,
mm-hmm.
and the way they deal with the Quran. And every time you would point out, look, here's the inconsistency, you're showing these set of rules for this and this set of rules for your own Quran. And Shabir Ali kind of swept that under the rug and said, well, I was here to debate the New Testament. I'm not here to debate the inspiration of the Quran. If you want to debate that, let's debate that. So my question is, what being that they use such an extremely high double standard against the New Testament, what do they have to offer from their side with the Quran? I mean, with the New Testament and the Old Testament, you know, we have prophecy, history, archaeology, things like that. The transforming power, the worldview that it presents being consistent and makes sense and everything. What do they have to offer?
Interestingly enough, I don't remember how long ago this was. I believe that we should sometime. I know that I listened to, because I remember the specific ride on which I listened to it, a lecture that Shabir delivered to Muslims on the nature of the Quran as the inspired word of God. You can find all sorts of lectures given by Jamal Badawi and Shabir and D-Dot and so on and so forth on these subjects, and they partake of the same elements. I don't remember if I played that on the Dividing Line and responded to elements or not. I may not have now that I think about it. But be that as it may, in essence, it boils down to a highly evidentialist argument plus a very subjective one. I mentioned one of the arguments a couple of weeks ago, and that's derived from the Quran itself, where they argue that no one has ever been able to produce anything to rival the Quran or to be the equal of the Quran. And I pointed out that this is an exceptionally subjective argument. I think Robbie Burns, the Bard of Scotland, was far better in many of his writings than anything you'd find in the Quran, but it's subjective. It's what hits you. It's what you find to be compelling or communicative or whatever else it might be. And I certainly think that there are sections of the scriptures that are, you know, the poetry you find in the Psalter and in Isaiah, for example, totally beyond anything you find in the Quran. But again, how can that be an argument? It can't be an argument because it is totally subjective. But then they try to attach to that pretty much a very evidentialist string of argumentation. They, for example, will interpret the Quran in a very unusual way, as if it presents embryology. And they will argue that if you read certain words this way and certain words that way, that this is describing the embryo as it's developing at a very small stage. And since microscopes hadn't been discovered yet, then how could Muhammad have this kind of incredibly in-depth knowledge of the embryological states? And to be honest with you, Western readers go to these texts fully knowledgeable of the Arabic language and go, you've got to be kidding me. There is absolutely no reason to understand these words in this context. This is a huge, huge, huge leap. Basically it's on the same level, I would say, as what you see on a lot of TBN programs about prophecies and things along those lines. It's just as much of a huge reach to read the Quran in that way as
like the Bible code?
In fact, I was about to get to that. They even have a Quran code. Most people probably didn't understand this, but when I had the cross-examination period with Shabir, at one point I mentioned 6,500 something, and he chuckled and said, "Oh, I didn't know you knew that." And what I was referring to was a presentation, and I did discuss this, I think, in March or April of 2005 in the archives of the PRBC Sunday School at prbc.org. And you might be able to, I don't know if the titles would necessarily give you that much information, but I went over the Quran code with my Sunday School class, those poor people, because I had been listening. It might have actually been January, February, because I remember when I was listening to this, I was riding my bike and it was cold. So that would have been probably January, February, March, somewhere in there. And what they do is they take the number of the surahs, and there's 114, And they put them in one column, and they divide them between odds and evens, and then the number of verses in the surahs, and they put them in cross columns, odds and evens, and we add them up. Somehow you get these numbers, and it's the same on one side as it is on the other, and this proves the inspiration of the Quran, basically. And it does rival anything that you will find in the Bible code books, where you add, subtract, multiply, and divide, however you want to make it work out. So he has actually presented that, Shabir has presented that, as evidence of the inspiration of the Quran. And so they'll say that it couldn't have come from Muhammad, and that Muhammad was obviously an honest individual. He really believed these things. And since there's supernatural evidence of embryology in it, they will try to point to one or two really stretched ideas of prophecy. Well, the Romans are going to defeat these people in a couple of years. And it's so vague it's sort of be like saying something along the lines of there are going to be major military developments in the Middle East over the next couple of years. Like, duh, you think? Type of a situation, but it lacks specificity. But they will try to come up with that. And Muhammad himself felt the weight of the objection that he did no miracles and things like that. And so you have his flight to Jerusalem that will be put forward as a example of a supernatural event. Verifying the correctness of the Quran as well. But it's a string of pretty much unrelated evidentialist type arguments connected with that one subjective argument about the alleged supremacy of the Quran as far as a written document is concerned, that comes up over and over again in the lectures that I've heard delivered on why the Quran is to be considered the Word of God.
Do they have anything, because the more popular books that are out there that have been here For some years now, Josh McDowell wrote Evidence That Demands the Verdict, mm-hmm. and More Evidence That Demands the Verdict. And these are big, bulky type books getting into a lot of different issues. I haven't actually read them myself, but they get into a lot of issues from what I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wonder if do they have their own little counterpoint on the Bible, or is it just, maybe a lecture here and there by guys like Shabir Ali with this kind of argumentation? Because go ahead.
Yeah, no, there are entire books. Most of the fuller books are normally because they're taking time to attack the Christian faith. There is, for example, a book that is, I don't know, 600 pages attacking the deity of Christ using every bad Jehovah's Witness argument I've ever seen, plus a few even worse ones thrown in for good measure. So the big ones tend to be those that are focused upon specifically attacking the Christian faith. But yes, there are all sorts of books that are published. You can go to IslamicBookstore.com and look these things up. They are not paying for any advertising time here, however, where there will be, the divine proofs of the Quran and things like that. But they don't tend to be overly huge. I mean, there might be some that are, but they tend to be more booklets than they are huge works, because there's only so many things. Now, for example, they have books like Science and the Quran and things like that, where they really try to expand out these embryology contexts and things like that. But they certainly try to put those things out, especially when they find themselves in situations like they are in the United States, where they are in the religious minority. It would not be as much of an issue when they are in the religious majority, because in essence, criticism of Islam will be stamped out and silenced at that point. And so apologetics becomes that which you do at the end of the sword or the AK-47 barrel.
Okay.
All righty?
All right. Well, thank you very much. God bless.
Thank you for calling. God bless. 877-753-3341 is the phone number. We continue with Shabir Ali. Have you noticed at this point, I've got to offer a little criticism for my Christian brother here. Mike's doing what a lot of Christians do in this situation, and it's something that I don't. And it may be one of the reasons I'm considered a hard nose. But if you're in this situation where you've got cross-examination, and I know I've watched the DVD, and I can tell that the context they were in, he was basically being told to, take it easy and bend over backwards, and we don't want any hard feelings, blah, 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 blah. You know, it was sort of like when we showed up at Biola and they had the same type of set up where we're going to sit here with little flowers and on couches and have a nice little discussion. And I said, no, we're going to have a debate, and you need to have a table to write on when you have a debate. And so we changed that. But anyway, Shabir's getting all this time. Shabir Ali is getting all this time. If I haven't done it, it wouldn't be something that I would invest time in doing. But I think if you took the cross-examination period here and counted up the amount of time that Shabir had and the amount of time that Mike had, it's probably 3-1 Shabir's favor. And Shabir is not asking questions. He's making arguments. And I would be interrupting him. And I would be responding. And I would be getting my time. That's what you've got to do. I mean, you know, and there just seems to be a tendency on the part of a lot of folks, and I know some people look at me and go, that's just because you're mean and you're rude. And no, if it's a debate, I need to have 50-50 here. And when Shabir will make some of these comments, I'm going to be stepping on the last word of his last sentence, because that's the only way you get a word in edgewise. Otherwise, you will be dominated by the other person. And if the other person gets three times more time than you have, I don't care how good your arguments are. You're not going to be able to get them stated. You've got to have enough time to at least state them and challenge the facts that are being facts or non-facts that are being presented. And so you've got to have a little bit of a fighter's spirit there to jump in and do what you got to do.
About the empty tomb. Now, historians...
I'm sorry, can I get a moment
please,
to respond to that?
Yeah, see, okay. Jump in there. Go for it. Don't say I'm sorry. Mike, don't say I'm sorry. Jump in there and say, I need to respond to what you just said, and go for it. There's no reason to say, I'm sorry, because he's supposed to be asking you questions anyways, and he's not. He's pontificating. So dive in there and do what you need to do.
You're still dealing with the Gospels. And I'm appealing to this very early evidence, which predates it by decades.
But you have answered that. I've shown that this earliest evidence, first of all, the sources are not known. If you cite James Dunn as saying that this was early, that's James Dunn's guess. I respect him as a great scholar, and I read his writings. But after all, it is a scholarly guess from one individual.
When I first heard that, unfortunately, it was while I was descending South Mountain, and it almost killed me because I just could not believe that Shabir Ali was stating that, because Shabir Ali will utilize the personal idiosyncratic opinions of any scholar on the planet to make a point. I mean, I disagree with James D.G. Dunn on all sorts of stuff, consistently so, but he is well recognized in his particular field. And yet Shabir will pick people who are not recognized in any field, who are so far out of the mainstream that it's not even funny, and who again would hold a worldview completely contradictory to his own that totally determines their conclusions on a scholarly level. And yet he'll take one of those people and present them as facts. That's what he did with the Gospel of Thomas in our debate. He picks one female Jesuit liberal at Boston College and presents it as if it somehow is a fact, when it's the viewpoint of one idiosyncratic person. It wasn't even James D.G. Dunn. And so to do this and say, well, you presented Dunn, but that's just one opinion or something like that. It's like, whoa. Talk about a double standard.
But he also may have a different guess. And that's
just
that
name me charisma. Any scholars, yes? That just name me any New Testament historians, okay? And as you know, in New Testament historians, it's largely critical. Many non-Christians, many non-believers, many atheists are in that discipline. Just name me a single New Testament scholar who doubts the death of Jesus.
Notice that I have acknowledged previously that all historians, you can include New Testament scholars, except for Muslims, would agree that Jesus died on the cross. Because it is an assumption that somebody who lived 2,000 years ago and is no longer alive is dead.
No, that is not an assumption. No. Does that mean that everybody who lived 2,000 years ago died on a cross under Pontius Pilate in a particular context, at a particular time in Jerusalem? Of course not. Yes, it is an assumption that if someone lived 2,000 years ago, they have died. Duh. That's not the issue. The issue is the means of death, the time, the context, the resultant burial, who would be there, who was involved, did Jesus predict it, etc., 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 etc.
But that's not why New Testament scholars are concluding that.
Well, they are concluding that for the same reason as everyone else, that Jesus died on the cross, not because they have any irrefutable proof. And I'm not using irrefutable in the ridiculous sense in which you've treated it. You see, you have firm evidence that Jesus was on the cross and died on the cross. You said so yourself. Everyone agrees on that. Mm-hmm. Now, do you have firm evidence that he resurrected from the dead? If someone claims that he resurrected from the dead, then we'd be wondering, did you really see him? And did he really die after all?
Now, you see what Shabir is doing here, and it's helpful. You know, sometimes I think people, if they don't know any Muslims, tend to sort of tune out at this point because I'm really not concerned about what Muslims are doing. But Muslim apologists are borrowing their arguments against the crucifixion, or more specifically against the resurrection, from basically atheists. They're more than happy to be quite naturalistic at this point, even though their worldview should preclude them from borrowing these particular arguments. And therefore, you have what he's doing here. Let me put it this way. It's similar to what I do in regards to the Roman Catholic papacy, but I think I'm doing it consistently and they aren't. What do I mean? I go through all of the things that must be true. And for the papacy to be true. In other words, you have to have this step, followed by this step, followed by this step, because Rome is claiming that they have the ultimate and final power and say in all of these things. And so if, you know, Peter has to have gone to Rome, and Peter has to be the fulfillment in Matthew 16, and you have all these things that have to go along to fulfill that, so that condition. What Shabir is doing is saying, well, look, okay, let's even say that Jesus died on a cross. How do you know he resurrected? Because, first of all, how do you know it was him? So you raise all sorts of identity issues. And can you trust the people who said they saw him? And so now you're raising issues about the witnesses. And what he's trying to do is to bring up some sort of deniability here, some sort of levels of deniability to try to force the Christian over all these hurdles. And by the time you get to the top, the probability of what you're promoting becomes very small. See, that's the argumentation that is taking place here. And that's not just a Muslim thing. That's something that unbelievers do on a regular basis.
So it is in the light of the later claim that I'm asking, did he really die on the cross? Show me the evidence that he actually died on the cross. What fatal wound killed him on the cross?
Okay.
And I've named Raymond Brown, who has gone through a long discussion on this, and finally, he cannot conclude what would have killed him. Of course, if you took him down and you buried him under 6 feet of dirt, he would have died. But that's not what happened to him. So what really killed Jesus? You said yourself, the medical doctors could not agree on what was the cause of death. So if you don't know the cause of death...
So here comes the next doubt element, and that is, in talking to a westernized culture that is the first, well, maybe second generation to even possess the level of medical knowledge which we have now, the instrumentation that we have due to computerization, things like that, to be able to monitor all these life functions like that. Talking to an audience like that, you can now, in essence, engage in the people before us were stupid argument and say, well, you know, it would have been much more probable, the swoon theory. See, now we'd be able to tell whether someone was really dead or not. But back then they couldn't. And so you've got that question, and you got the question of the resurrection, and was it the right person they recognized, and can we trust the witnesses? And it's as was just said in channel Dogpiling the Doubt. You know, just try to pile on as much of it as you possibly can.
The only thing we can say is that a man who lived 2,000 years ago and is no longer with us is dead. And I think that's a universal conclusion. But if you say he reappeared to his disciples, then we should go back and look to see whether he was actually dead. And we cannot find the evidence that he was actually dead, can we?
Okay. Now, I think we can. Everybody attests to it. Our understanding of crucifixion militates against it, and medically, the doctors are saying he died. But I do want to comment on Brown. because you mentioned about the spear wound in Brown, and that's correct. John does mention it, but John's the only one who mentions nails for crucifixion. It's not even in a crucifixion scene. He mentions that to Thomas, you see the nail wounds. He's the only one that mentions the cruor fragium, or the breaking of legs. The others didn't do that either, but we don't deny that nails were used in crucifixion or that legs weren't broken. Let me give you a quote by Raymond Brown, since you like to use him. This is in Death of the Messiah, the same book that you quoted from, page 1092 and 93. People who would never bother reading a responsible analysis of the traditions about how Jesus was crucified, died, was buried, and rose from the dead are fascinated by the report of some new insight to the effect he was not crucified or did not die. And then on page 1373 he says, except for the romantic few who think that Jesus did not die on the cross, most scholars accept the uniform testimony of the Gospels that Jesus died during the Judean prefecture of Pontius Pilate. So, again, you brought up the Gospels, and I'm on this other hill, and Raymond Brown is with me.
Not really. Not really, because if you read Raymond Brown carefully from the page that you quoted, and I've read it myself as well, that's from the section in which he's dealing with fanciful, imaginative scenarios, whereas, for example, the Ahmadiyyas have claimed that Jesus walked all the way to Kashmir and he died and buried there. Or recently there was an Australian lady, Fearing, who claimed that Jesus came back and he was still alive and he got married to Mary Magdalene.
Right.
Brown was responding to this kind of imaginative detail. But Brown himself, in the section, if you've read it, dealing with the physiological cause of Christ's death, gives a different picture. In the end, he looks at the kinds of medical examinations that have been done now post-mortem, way thousands of years after the fact, and he dismisses them because he says that the details that are given by the gospel writers should not be taken as actual physical details that occurred, but they are due to a number of factors, including imaginative detail added by the evangelists themselves.
Which is another reason why I would ask the question. And this is one of the problems you get when you don't challenge the Raymond Brown, say, oh, it's one of the greatest New Testament scholars ever. In what context? If Raymond Brown were to take the same worldview and viewpoint of inspiration and accuracy and things like that and apply it to the Quran as a Muslim, Shabir Ali would never accept him as being a Muslim in the first place. But we have to accept him as a Christian, and in fact, the greatest Christian scholar around. And when Christian apologists don't challenge that and say, well, wait a minute, I would have fundamental foundational differences with Raymond Brown. I mean, yes, man has an ability to collect all sorts of data and analyze all sorts of data, but it's the grid through which he's analyzing these things, it becomes the issue. If you're not willing to say that because, ooh, that's not popular in the academy and you're not going to get invited to speak at the nicest places if you do that, well, I would rather have a consistent position to stand upon to defend the gospel against Islam than to get invited to all the nice places, to be perfectly honest with you. And if you don't do that, you're just not going to be able to respond in a proper way. Well, anyway, thank you for listening to The Dividing Line today. Remember, next week, we will not be here, but we will be back, Lord willing, the week after that. So July 3rd will be our next program on a Tuesday morning. Look forward to seeing you then. God bless.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.